Not Your Boyfriend's Sports Show.
I'm your host, Maeve, and this week on the show, we're talking basketball analytics with Ian Levy, executive editor of Hardwood Paroxysm and a regular contributor to 538. We discuss the data gap between men's and women's hoops, what it would take to make women's data robust, and try to answer the riddle of supply and demand in sports fandom. Plus, this week in sports, the UConn Huskies make history, and the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team file a wage discrimination complaint. And apologies for my somewhat husky voice, I'm getting over a little bit of a cold. Don't worry, I don't sound like this when I recorded with Ian last week, but none of this will stop the sports talk. So, this week in sports, the UConn Huskies made history by winning their fourth straight national championship, an unprecedented record on the women's side. Up until now, only the UCLA men's team had such a streak when they won seven in a row during their 1967-73 run. UConn coach Gino Auriemma took home his 11th national title, surpassing legendary John Wooden's record. Breanna Stewart also made history by becoming the first college basketball player, men's or women's, to be named Most Outstanding Player four times, and she ends her college career on a streak of 75 consecutive wins, all by double digits. Pretty incredible stuff. Their historic tournament run was not without controversy, however, when Boston Globe columnist Dan Shaughnessy tweeted that UConn's dominance was, quote, killing the game, an argument he stood by and expanded upon in a subsequent article. Coach Auriemma stood by his team and their record, pointing out instances in men's sports where dominance is applauded, not questioned, and ultimately telling Shaughnessy not to watch if he doesn't think it's important. We'll unpack the storyline a little bit more in the conversation with Ian and whether Shaughnessy's arguments hold up, but first, our last story for today. The U.S. women's national team has filed a federal complaint accusing U.S. soccer, the sport's governing body, of wage discrimination. Citing their World Cup and Olympic wins, the women argue that they are being shortchanged on everything from bonuses to per diems compared to the men's team. In perhaps the clearest example of the discrepancy in pay, the women's team was paid $2 million when they won their third World Cup in 2015. The men's team received $9 million without even advancing beyond the round of 16. That was in 2014, and let's just note here that the men's team has never made it past the quarterfinals. But this is just one example of how pay is not equal. For friendly matches required as part of their contract, the women get paid as much for winning as the men get just for showing up, win or lose. And when traveling, the men get $75 for their daily expenses, while women get $60. While the women do get paid a $72,000 salary and the men do not, their argument is that the men still get paid more when you factor in all the bonuses, appearances, and sponsorships. And in perhaps the most stinging aspect of it all, the women's team drew more revenue for U.S. soccer last year, fueled by their World Cup win, which was the most watched soccer game in U.S. history. This was a nice detail to point out to all the doubters, but I think what it actually highlights is a model for investing in women's sports. The women's success didn't happen overnight. It's been the better part of a couple decades. But it speaks to the notion that women's sports can be profitable, even more profitable than men's, if given the right support, an example we also see in women's tennis. That being said, I was disappointed by U.S. Soccer's initial comment on the matter, in which they called the complaint, quote, disappointing, and reminded everyone how much they've done for women's soccer over the past 30 years. But it's not 30 years ago, and to paraphrase Hope Solo, female athletes are tired of being told to be grateful. Yes, U.S. soccer made a good investment, and now it's a big success. Reinvest in your program by paying your players what they're worth. As Alex Morgan noted, this suit is also for the young girls playing right now who will one day take their spots. That's it for this week in sports, and when we come back, we'll talk with Ian Levy. Welcome back to the show. I am so happy to be joined today by Ian Levy. Ian is the editor-in-chief of Hardwood Paroxysm, which includes the website Nylon Calculus, which is a basketball analytics source. And he's also a regular contributor to 538. So, Ian, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me on. I'm excited.
So just to start off really simple, for the uninitiated, for those who might not know that much about basketball, what are some of the basic stats that it's important to follow besides, you know, points, rebounds, assists, turnovers, you know, besides the rudimentary things? If you want to go to the next level in your understanding, where should you start?
Well, one of the first things that's happened, like, or that started happening over the past decade, was people started taking those basic building blocks, box score stats, points, rebounds, assists, those things that were easy to count, and they just started putting them over different denominators, basically looking at them as different sorts of rates. So originally everything was points per game. But then you had this problem where, so you want to maybe compare a starting player who plays 35 minutes a game to a bench player who only plays 15 minutes a game, but you want to compare the quantity of their scoring on an even playing field. So what you would do is you would look at their points per 36 minutes. Mm-hmm. So then you're equalizing the denominator, and it gives you sort of another comparison. Another big one is pace adjustment, which is teams play on both the men's and women's sides. Teams play at very different speeds. So a team that plays an up-tempo game will have more possessions during the course of the game, which means more opportunities for points, rebounds, and assists than somebody who plays for a slower-paced team. One of the big leaps in basketball analytics was starting to look at points, rebounds, assists, and things like that per 100 possessions. You'll still occasionally hear, like on a TV broadcast, people will still reference points per game, something like that. But it's mm-hmm. it's not an ideal measure of the quality of a team's offense. You want to look at things per 100 possessions. And then from there, it spirals into all sorts of things. There's, you know, comprehensive player metrics and things that rely on regression analysis and all sorts of things. But if you understand the building blocks and can stretch yourself with some basic division and look at things over different sorts of denominators, you can answer a lot more detailed questions.
All right, so a stats 101 level of knowledge, and you can really impress people next time you're at the bar. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you had to compare kind of the development of analytics in basketball compared to some of the other major sports, are they all kind of similarly evolved at this point, or is basketball at a different kind of point in time?
I think the investment on the team level is fairly similar, let's say, from baseball to basketball. I'm not as familiar with baseball, but I think at this point every team has analytics departments, have sort of dedicated analytics staff, and I know that's the case now at the basketball, on the NBA at least. I think football and hockey are a little bit behind. I think probably football is the furthest behind. I think one of the issues is sort of the nature of each individual sport lends itself to analytic implementation at different levels. So sort of the finite nature of actions in baseball, the fact that you have sort of a one-on-one interaction between a pitcher and a batter, that sort of eliminates some variables. And so it makes some of the entry-level stuff in baseball maybe more powerful than kind of entry level stuff would be in basketball. So when you think about the progression of where each sport is, I think a lot of it has to do with the nature of the game and the challenges that presents.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, any baseball fan who's attended a game has seen, you know, the old guys with their scorecard keeping track of every inning. So it's very ingrained in baseball for sure. But I think, you know, the point we're making is that analytics have become a really important component to all kinds of sports these days. And like you mentioned, teams have their own analytics departments. Certainly the rise of fantasy sports has led to kind of increased attention on stats when, mm-hmm. you know, you're not just following a team anymore, but you're trying to make decisions about an individual player. But I want to go back a little bit because I came across your work because of an article that you wrote for 538, and it was called "A Website Went Offline and Took Most of Women's College Basketball Analytics With It." So first of all, can you give the listeners a little bit of background about that article and what it said and kind of the availability of women's college basketball stats more generally?
So the genesis of the article was there's really to my knowledge, there has been one major publicly available or easily accessible source for advanced statistics in women's college basketball. And in even advanced might be a stretch. I'm talking about simple things like per 40 minute adjusted, point adjustments, things beyond points per game and assists per game. And that was this website called WBB State. And that was the only one that I had been available, was the had interacted with. It was the only one I had really used. So my editor at one of my editors at 538 approached me and he asked me if I wanted to write some team capsules about teams going into the women's college tournament. And WBBstate.com had just gone offline that week. They had a problem with their hosting company, and the entire website was down. So I said
Good
I'd love to
timing.
do that. I said I'd love to do this article, but it's going to be a challenge because sort of the only source that really has anything useful is offline right now. And so he sort of asked me some questions about that. And he said, that's a really interesting story. Why don't we write that up? So a little bit of digging, and it was a financial problem between the hosting company and somebody else that they owed money to, and they sort of went belly up basically overnight. I don't think WBB State had any warning that it was going offline. And then it was just gone, and still we're, I don't know, about a month later, and supposedly they're making progress on getting some of their data back, but the last time I looked, the website was not up. So what you're left with then is the stuff that ESPN has and the stuff that's on the NCAA's website, which is points per game, team scoring per game, really, really basic measures. And then the other aspect of it is that it's in a format that's really hard to use. There's no searchability, there's no filtering, so you couldn't do something like look at rebounds per game by all players who have played at least 20 games during the season. If you wanted to do something like that, you'd have to manually cut and paste all of the things out and put it into another source to work with. So it was just really striking that not only is there a really limited amount of data that's publicly available for women's college basketball, but the stuff that is there by nature of being so limited, something freaky like a financial problem for a hosting company can basically, just remove it from the public sphere completely.
And so how does this compare to the availability of men's data? Because let's say that you wanted to write the same article about the men's college teams, what resources are available to you and how would you go about it?
There's a lot more resources on the men's side. What's interesting is that WBB State was still a for-profit website. I think you had to pay like $12 or something for a yearly subscription. So there was a paywall, but it was really accessible. But on the men's side, there's a ton of resources. Some of them are free, some of them are behind paywalls. But there's a lot there and a lot that's really easy to get to. So Sports Reference is a stats company, and they have databases for all kinds of sports. And their men's college basketball database has play index searchability things. So you can look at, the last 15 years of college basketball. I want everybody who played at least 15 minutes a game and averaged at least 5 points, 5 rebounds, 5 assists. Put that in, and you'll get that really, really quickly. Whereas, on the women's side, that might be an hour's worth of manual searching. And then, one of the major resources on the men's side is KenPom.com, Ken Pomeroy, and he has all sorts of individual players, advanced player statistics, but he also has really comprehensive team ratings, which are a great measure of team strength, with strength of schedule adjustments, things like that. And they're sort of much more accurate than what's available on the women's side. And from having talked to Ken a little bit, I know that that started as sort of a passion project for him, not a money-making thing. It was to satisfy his own curiosity, and enough people were interested in it that it sort of turned into a business where it's now behind a paywall. And I think he, a good share of his income comes from that. And I think there's an interesting corollary there for the women's side. I think you know, I think there's space for people who are curious and interested to sort of push the envelope and build some of these things on their own. And then once they're out there, they get more attention, more people are interested, and they sort of, the demand grows.
Yeah. So I'm glad that you mentioned this demand element of it, because, you know, your article is one of a sort of recent slew of examples of what you called the scarcity and fragility of women's sports stats. So Sue Bird, who's a WNBA player, she also wrote recently for the Players Tribune about how difficult it is to get reliable stats for even the WNBA. And then last year, Allison McCann, who's also at 538, she wrote an article that outlined many more examples across the sports universe where women's data lags pretty significantly behind men's. And, you know, if you look at the comments on these articles, yours included, I don't know if you've looked at those comments.
Unfortunately, I have. I don't follow that rule.
But, you know, if you took the comments at their word, you'd know that it's a pretty simple supply and demand problem, and that, you know, there's just no demand for women's sports data. So that's why it's not there. And if people actually cared about women's sports, they would generate more traffic, and then there would be a plethora of information and options available. Mm-hmm. So do you agree with this argument laid out by brilliant commenters around the web? And why or why not?
I think there is some truth to the idea that if there was more demand, people would deliver. But I don't think that I think that misses the aspect of how the data drives demand. I have watched basketball analytics on the men's side really grow over the past decade, and it's almost all of the growth is done or is initially done by curious people in the public sphere who are trying to answer questions on their own. And very few people start at this trying to make money. It's a little bit different now that there are sort of obvious opportunities. The proliferation of advanced analytics on the men's side really started with Dean Oliver. So like in 2001, I think, so 15 years ago, he started a forum on the old Yahoo GeoCities thing and invited some people he knew. And this little community sort of is what basketball analytics on the men's side grew out of. A lot of the people who were sort of started in that forum are now working for teams. It's Kevin Pelton who's writing for ESPN. Dean Oliver has worked for a number of teams. It's Roland Beach, who's the director of analytics for the Kings and formerly for the Mavericks. Aaron Barzilai, who was director of analytics for the 76ers. I mean, all these people who sort of are doing this now professionally started in this forum, and most of them were people who worked in other fields, had some sort of data expertise that was not specifically sports related, but they were basketball fans and they started doing it. Myself, I have no data background at all. I was originally an elementary school teacher before I really took the leap into doing this full time. But I read that forum. It's called the APBR Metrics Forum, and it still exists. And I started reading that about 10 years ago and was fascinated and wanted to learn more. And it led me to all of these other resources. And
so this is sort of like the Nate Silver mold, right? He's probably one of the most famous examples of, like, he's working at some dumb insurance job that he hates. And in the meantime, he's like playing around with baseball stats. And next thing you know, he's like running a data analytics empire. So let's say that somebody did want to kind of get their hands dirty and create the information environment for the WNBA that currently exists for the NBA. If money weren't an issue, if time weren't an issue, all the rest of those typical barriers, from a purely logistical perspective, what would it take to bring women's basketball stats up to speed?
So there's a few different things. A lot of the basic work. So the WNBA is a little bit ahead of women's college basketball. It's actually pretty far ahead of women's college basketball. It's not up to the NBA's level, but they have some advantages. So like at Sports Reference, again, there's a WNBA section that has quite a bit more than you would find on the college side. But it's somebody being willing to host a database and sort of build structure into the data so that people can search things. I think, I think searchability is one of the biggest aspects of this because, I mean, the ideal is to make a large amount of data available and make it useful to whoever happens to be looking. So it would not be a huge stretch to add some features to like what Sports Reference has, or for somebody to build a database where they're scraping daily box scores from the WNBA. And from there, they could do per 100 possession adjustments and true shooting percentages and usage rates and all of those things. The big frontier in the WNBA, and I'm happy to say that Nylon Calculus is helping to work on this, the big frontier is play-by-play data. And that was, it was a huge leap in the NBA side when people started scraping play-by-play data. And basically,
can you give listeners an idea of what play-by-play data is?
Yeah, so if you go to ESPN or the WNBA's website and you are go to the little capsule for a game, there'll be a couple different tabs, and one of the tab will be you'll get like a little recap of the game. One of them will be you can look at the box score and you can see the box score stats for each team, and then there will be another one that's a play-by-play stream, and so it's sort of a running narrative of what happens in the story, right? So, or what happened in the game. So it's, you know, Maya Moore gets a defensive rebound, Brittany Griner blocks the shot and whatever. And so it will have timestamps on it. And it will have the score as each event occurs, it will update the score. And it will also include things like fouls and substitutions. So, why that data is so important is that it can be scraped and aggregated, and it lets you build statistics like looking at five-person lineups. You can look at all of these statistics that we've talking about based on which five players are on the floor at the same time. And that has been a really important advancement on the men's side. And then from that sort of five-person unit data, you can build some of these all-in-one comprehensive metrics that we have on the men's side, things like real plus-minus, regularized adjusted plus-minus, statistical plus-minus, and those are complicated and convoluted, but the idea is
they sound complicated.
they're not things that I am capable of building myself, but the idea basically is if you have all of this data, you can look at the five players on the floor and the five players they're playing against, how long they played and what the score is. You can use these complicated statistical techniques to measure player value, and essentially you can account for how good is player A if we adjust for which players she plays with and which players she plays against. So we can account for players who play all the time with really good players and how that maybe makes them look better than they are. Or we can account for players who always play against the opponent's bench units and that makes them look better than they are. You can sort of account for all of those things and you can arrive at an estimated player value sort of all in one. But none of that's possible without play-by-play data. And Seth Partnow, who's our managing editor at Nylon Calculus, has been able to get some WNBA play-by-play streams, and he has been, over the past few weeks, he has been assembling five-woman lineup data for the WNBA. I think he's got 8 years done, and he's been making that data accessible for anybody who wants to use it, play with it, build off it, anything you want to do with it.
Well, I was actually reading one of his articles. I guess the title was Deep Diving WNBA Data, Griner's Paint Defense. Mm-hmm. So he sort of uses this play-by-play setup to look at, you know, how good Brittany Griner is, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so I'm reading through the footnotes also, because I think footnotes are where you find the best nuggets of information. And I read one of these footnotes that he wrote, and it just to me spoke to kind of the challenge. And he was talking about the play-by-play data availability. And then on the men's side, you can essentially have like three players at any given play-by-play, like bullet point, and they all have a unique player ID number. Mm-hmm. But on the women's side, there are fewer spaces for a player, called a player identifier.
I know what Seth was talking about in that footnote is that in the underlying play-by-play data on the men's side, each player is assigned a unique numeric code, and that's included in the raw data. And on the women's side, I believe you don't even get first names, and you may not even get a first initial. So I think one of the problems he was having is you might have a game where there are three different Johnsons in the game, two who play for for one team and one who plays for the other team, and you might not be able to tell which Johnson scored that basket or, you know, or got that rebound or whatever. And so so part of the challenge for him in building the data set that he's built so far is going back in and doing some of those adjustments manually.
Yeah. Well, so it sounds like this play-by-play example is a good example whereby a database sort of emerged almost accidentally because its original purpose was to just kind of create like a live feed while games were happening. But there are also some like really intentional things that the NBA does or other sports leagues do. So I was wondering if you could talk with us a little bit about Sports VU. Am I calling it that correctly?
Sport View, yeah. They are high-tech cameras. They're they have a deal with the NBA now, so there's cameras in all 29 arenas. And the cameras, I think there's 6 or 8 cameras. They see the whole floor. The sort of the legend or the mythology around this system is that it was originally built for missile defense. I don't know the degree to which that's true, but that's sort of the legend. That's where the technology originally came from. But so they take 25 shots a second, and they turn the visual data into sort of a raw numeric data stream. So from the raw data stream, you can see things like how many times a player dribbles the ball, how long they have the ball before they pass it. You can see the distance between a shooter and a defender. You can filter things down to, you know, how many times a player is touching the ball at the elbow. There's sort of a huge variety of things that can be built off it. And essentially, it's the raw data stream is all what you can pull from the raw data stream is only limited by your imagination and your technical expertise. So,
but this is an example where like the league has made an investment in this technology and the stories that are coming out of this data source are kind of leading other narratives.
Yeah, absolutely. And originally SportView had contracts with specific teams. So I think the first year there was like 4 teams that had it. And then the next year there was like 10 teams that had it. The issue there was that you sort of get an incomplete data set. So if you're one of the teams who has the camera in your arenas and only 9 other teams have it, you only have access to the games that are at your arena. So you are, you know, you're only sort of getting a snapshot of your team's data. You're only getting half the data. So I think there was some impetus from the teams that were invested pushing the league to say, hey, let's put this in everywhere and let's make the data accessible to everybody. And then part of the deal with the league was the league negotiated so that there is a host of publicly available statistics on the NBA's website that are derived from this. So as somebody who writes about this, it offers the chance to tell a whole slew of different kinds of stories in sort of confident and specific ways.
But you've written about SportView as an example, kind of in this supply versus demand debate, where supply is leading the demand in this instance, right? It's not like there were all of these basketball fans out there who are like, you know what I'd really like to know is how many shots are being taken, you know, from, I don't know, like this particular point on the court or something like that. Like this is an example where there was some infrastructure built in with an initial upfront cost that then has led and influenced a pretty big number of stories now. Yes.
Yeah. And I don't, so I'm some of this is like sort of off rumor and some of it is off gut and just sort of my perception of how things work. But my sense of this is the reason that we have public sport view data is not because anybody significant in the public asked for it. Although, you know, there were stat heads like me who were like, wouldn't it be cool if we could see this stuff? But I think the reason we have it is because the teams who were really invested in it wanted the full data set, and that meant having it at every arena. And the only way they could get it at every arena was by having the league enforce it. And then once the league has the deal and they're getting this data, it's you know, it's worth it for them to sprinkle some of it out in the public and get some return on their investment. I know right. that I use these SportView statistics a ton. I would guess that the average NBA fan might not even know they exist. But my guess is that it's a very small fraction of the NBA's right. digital fans who are actually curious about these, aware that they exist, and using them with any regularity.
Well, so I guess that the larger point here is that, you know, this supply and demand argument tilts on whether or not fans drive demand or whether, like, supplied stories drive fandom. Can you speak a little bit to, you know, your view on how much of this fandom and excitement is kind of manufactured? Or, like, maybe why this is or isn't happening on the women's side compared to the men's side?
I think some of it is just size. I mean, the number of people who are paying attention to women's sports leagues is much smaller than the number of people who are paying attention to the men's professional sports leagues. I guess if I was specifically going to talk about the WNBA and the NBA, the size of those fan bases is completely out of balance. And then the media complexes that cover each one of those leagues is probably even more out of balance than the actual fandom. I think there's probably a pretty strong argument that WNBA fans are underserved in the media and NBA fans are probably overserved in the media. I think the men's side has shifted a little bit and probably diluted some enthusiasm on the women's side. I'm probably not saying that right, but like, so 10 years ago on the men's side, the idea of writing a blog about basketball statistics and working for a team was pretty far-fetched. But people did it anyway because they were curious, and we had these huge data advances because people were willing to invest that time. And I think now people are much less willing to invest that time publicly because there is this obvious route to getting a job on the men's side. And so I think maybe there are some people who would be interested in who have the technical expertise, who are interested in women's basketball and would be interested in investing time in doing that, but they are distracted by the possibility of, well, if I work with men's data, maybe I get a job with a team, you know, maybe I get, maybe I'm able to sort of follow this path more. There's more people doing this as an audition for something else, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And I think that hurts the women's side because there's not as much to audition. There's not as much to audition for on the women's side. WNBA teams, at least right now, are not out there scrambling to hire, you know, vice president of data research. And so, you know, people spend more time with the men's data than maybe otherwise would.
Yeah, I think something that I always come back to is sports exist within structures and they exist within, you know, industry infrastructures. And you can choose where to invest or not to invest. Like the MLS, when it started the first 5 years, it lost $250 million. It's not like men's sports start and their immediate successes. There's all this other stuff that goes into it. And I think that like data and analytics is kind of like the newest frontier in what makes people care about sports. I don't know. I guess what I'm hearing from you, your argument is that a smart move would be to be the person who like brings women's basketball stats up to speed, for example.
I mean, I not to make us sound selfish and opportunistic, but I know that that's part of the rationale for Seth and I at Nylon Calculus, and one of the reasons that we've been trying to do more of this. I would like to say that it's all sort of selfless and doing it for, you know, for the good of everyone. But part of it is, hey, nobody else is doing this. If we get out in front of it, that helps make a name for this website that we work for. I think it would take very little investment from the WNBA to generate a big return in terms of interest and in terms of making these things more accessible. And I think I think if people sort of went out there and did the work and made a case for themselves, I think they'd be surprised how quickly this could sort of catch on more in the WNBA and get to a point where teams are interested in investing people and teams are hiring full-time analytics people and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it all comes back to like, I'm a really big baseball fan, right? And so if you sit down and think for a minute about all of the stats that like your average baseball fan keeps track of, like ERA being a really good example, For those who don't know, ERA stands for earned run average, and it's the number of runs that a pitcher allows during nine innings. But because a pitcher typically doesn't pitch a whole nine innings, you have ERAs that are not whole numbers. And like your average baseball fan knows what ERA is, like follows it, is using it in conversation, whatever. And you sit back from it and you're like, that's a totally statistical construct that like now Joe Schmo is using in his daily life, right? I think that you're making the point that like you can get people interested. Like if you build it, they will come, to use another sports metaphor.
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's a great metaphor. If you build it, they will come. I think like some of the reaction, like in the comments you were talking about to some of the things that have been written lately, is like, why are we going to build this huge elaborate thing if there's nobody here yet? And I think the answer is you don't have to build the whole thing. If that's the metaphor, build it and they will come. You don't have to build the entire data infrastructure and every sort of ideal. You don't have to build that right now. But start framing it in, start laying the foundation, and people will start to arrive. And as they come, you know, it's easier to justify the investment.
Yeah. All right. Well, I want to switch gears a little bit and go back to women's college basketball, which is where our whole conversation started. A big storyline that emerged during this year's March Madness on the women's side was whether or not the UConn Huskies are bad for the game. Dan Shaughnessy is a Boston Globe sports columnist, and I'm a Boston native, and Dan Shaughnessy has been an eternal thorn in my father's side. So I was especially piqued when he showed up. But anyway, he tweeted during the tournament that while he hates to punish UConn for their dominance, they're, quote, killing the women's game. Watch, no thanks. His argument basically being that it's not fun to watch blowout after blowout after blowout. So let's assume that Dan Shaughnessy is right here for the sake of argument. What are the basic reasons why there's more or less parity in the women's versus men's college game?
So it's sort of tricky because there is expected parity and actual parity. So the interesting argument to me is that theoretically there should be much more parity in women's college basketball than in men's college basketball, with the argument being that in men's college basketball, the best players frequently leave after 1 year. So Relative to a baseline, relative to the baseline, you would expect the freshman class of women to be as good as the freshman men's class. But every successive class after that in women's basketball, you would expect to be better relative to their own sort of personal baseline as opposed to the men, because the best players are continually sort of filtering out. Given that, I don't know what the argument is, or I don't know what the explanation is for UConn's dominance. Maybe this is a case where their profile is just so high that they are recruiting at a level that other schools sort of can't keep up with. And I don't know that there's a corollary on the men's side. Another thing that just occurred to me is maybe a good analogy would be, imagine John Calipari and his Kentucky Wildcats if nobody left early. And would they be as good relative to the rest of the field as UConn women are to the rest of the field if they kept those players for 4 years and were able to sort of develop them in the same way that UConn is. I also do not buy for a second the idea that UConn is bad for women's basketball or is ruining women's basketball. Anytime somebody says this is bad for the game or is ruining the game, immediately I'm like suspicious and ready to walk away. So many of those arguments are just objective nonsense. I feel like it's code for, I don't like this. I don't like the way this looks. Something about this offends my sensibilities.
I don't understand it, and so I don't follow it, and thus I don't want to like look dumb because I don't know what to say about it. So instead, I'll just say that it is stupid and doesn't matter.
Yeah. I mean, it's the Cynic's worldview. I'm not a media expert in terms of what works and what doesn't. So I don't know this for sure, but I would imagine that UConn's dominance has attracted far more attention to the women's game over the past 4 years than they would have gotten if they had just sort of been run of the mill, very good. And I think it doesn't hurt for a sport or league or whatever that is trying to grow and is trying to make inroads with new fans, having a transcendent team and a transcendent star like Breonna Stewart. I don't think that's bad. I think that's good. Even if they're pounding people by 30 points, people want to watch stars. They want to watch historic teams.
But I mean, something that is a little frustrating to me, you know, obviously this was a really historic season for UConn. They, you know, won their fourth in a row national championship. That's not only historic, but Breonna Stewart won most outstanding player 4 years in a row. That's not only historic, but they've now gone undefeated for like God knows how many games. That's not only historic, but you know, Ariema, their coach, is now like the most winning college basketball coach, men's or women's. Like, it's just this completely historic season. And then I don't know if it's laziness or just like a lack of good comparisons or what, but everything I was reading about Breonna Stewart this season was comparing her to like the Michael Jordans and the other great like college greats, and like what they accomplished and that sort of thing. And just like, well, now you're just sort of taking things like out of context, and you're trying to make her look really good, but it just makes it seem like an unfair comparison. And I don't know if that's the fault of like, you know, a lack of good data or a lack of other real superstars like her, or just like, you know, a quick, cheap, easy media storyline. But
I think
that it speaks to this point of like, you know, there's so much left to be done for women's sports so that when the next Breonna Stewart comes along, you can compare her to Breonna Stewart, you know?
Well, I think one of the problems is that sports writing as an entire field, men's, women's, tennis, basketball, whatever, has a tendency to like just sort of lilt towards reductive narratives. And I mean, on the men's side, we're still not quite done with like the search for the next Jordan, you know, like that's, I mean, it's silly and outrageous and right. People are still sort of not done with that idea. But I also think one of the unfortunate things on the women's side is that there's not a lot of dedicated women's beat writers. there are not a lot of, that makes it sound like women's beat writers are not dedicated.
I feel like all the women's beat writers are going to like come for your head now.
The women's beat writers are very dedicated, but there are not as many of them. And and so you often have like with this UConn run, people who were national writers who don't normally follow women's college basketball were sort of being asked to comment on Breonna Stewart and UConn because it was this big storyline. And I think they probably didn't have the expertise to sort of handle it in anything more than sort of like Jordan, you know, so these sort of like vague mythological narratives. You know, I think, you know, there were people out there who I think were writing about it in a smart and detailed and sort of nuanced way. But they maybe are not the writers who are at the top of the page on the first sports website you open in the morning.
Yeah, I mean, I think the dominance in men's and women's sports more generally is just treated so differently. Like, even you can just take this March Madness tournament, right? Like, UConn is beating everybody by like at least 20 points, often like more than 40 points. And, you know, that sucks for the game and that's not fun to watch, blah, blah, blah. But then in the Final Four, on the men's side, Villanova beat Oklahoma by 44 points and UNC beat Syracuse by 17 points. And people are just applauding like, oh, what great strategy, what strong programs, like that coach really knows what he's doing, those players. And it's just like treated so differently. It's like, oh, women's sports couldn't possibly just actually be really, really good and unique and special. Like it's just because the rest of women's sports is so bad.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that's a total double standard. I mean, recognizing, recognizing those blowouts as something unsavory, as being indicative of the gap in talent between UConn and the other team, instead of just being a reflection on where UConn's talent is. I think that's unfortunate.
Yeah, and the thing about UConn is, like, they're really dominant, but their dominance itself is kind of unheard of. Like, that level of dominance isn't just your run-of-the-mill dominance. Like, 538, I think it was Ben Morris, but he did this whole analysis of UConn. I think it was from last year, but he basically looked at, like, UConn versus last year when they were facing off against Notre Dame, and then compared to the rest of the pack. And, like, they not only had such a big difference between Notre Dame, who was next in line to them, but then they also, like, shadowed the distance between Notre Dame and the rest of the teams. So it's not just that they're much better than their opponent. It's that even when their opponent is much better than everybody else, they're that much better than everybody else.
Yeah, I had a quick sort of like Final Four lead-in thing for 538, and Neil Payne helped me out. Back to what we were talking about before, there's not a lot of great sort of detailed adjusted team ratings and rankings on the women's side, but he helped me out with some adjusted Jeff Sagarin numbers. And the UConn women's team, the last 4 years, they've been the last four women's UConn teams have been the best teams in college basketball over the last 4 years, and they have gotten better every year. So this year was the best team by a significant margin of the four UConn teams, and they're sort of like a steady upward progression. So they started better than everyone else, and they got better 3 years in a row, which is right. I don't know that there's really a precedent for it. Certainly not that I can think of off the top of my head.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're probably talking about the same article, because I probably found it through, like, linking everything that I was reading from your initial article. But so it was probably Neil Payne. But I mean, do you remember there's that chart with, like, the sort of V graph? It basically, like, put their rankings for three seasons, right? So you had one point on the graph that was their first season,
yes,
then a second season, then a third season. Mm-hmm. And most teams have, like, a very distinct V shape where they start at one point, they either get really good or really bad, and then they sort of, like, jump back up somewhere in the middle of that. Mm-hmm. And they're also all, like, clustered together in one spot. But then UConn is not only, like, way out as an outlier on the graph, but their V is, like, more of a line. Like, they're just so good. And I thought it was a really good example of where, like, data and analytics is showing you that the storyline you see on the surface of things, which is, like, UConn's really good, it's actually, like, so much more than that if you can see the numbers behind it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it really enriches the story. My favorite thing from the Ben Morris piece about UConn right before the tournament started was that over the past 4 years, they have outscored their opponents by an average of half a point a possession, which is not sort of an easily relatable number. But the idea is if they played a 100-possession game, they would win by an average of 50 points, which is – I mean,
which,
it's
like,
just
they
absurd.
Do.
How it shakes out. But it's amazing. Like, that's not the average for a 10-game stretch. That's not the average for, like, a tournament. Like, for 4 years, that's their aggregated dominance for 4 years, and nobody else was even close. A half a point of possession is, like, unheard of.
Yeah, it's nuts. It's just nuts. They're just so good. And, like, they don't get the credit for it because everybody gets too distracted by, like, well, who watches women's sports?
Well, anyway.
All right. Well, I don't want to take up too much more of your time. So I do, however, want to leave you with one final data point, which is you are the first man to be a guest on this show.
Oh, well, thank you. I'm honored. Honored
so
to be
we're really
together.
Tipping the scales in the other direction here at NYBF. But thank you so much for coming on. It was really, really great talking with you. I feel very enlightened, and I feel like I need to go, like, get another couple, you know, stats degrees so that I can save women's sports analytics.
Well, hopefully we'll keep rolling the ball forward. Hopefully, you know, this WNBA season, which is the 20th season, hopefully there'll be more stuff out there as the year goes on. And who knows what it'll look like by the time next college basketball season rolls around.
All right. Well, Ian, as I say to all of my guests, good game.
Good game. Thanks a lot for having me.
That's a wrap for this week, and thanks again to Ian for joining the show. As always, you can find us online, on Twitter, we're at NYBF Sports, we're on Facebook as Not Your Boyfriend's Sports Show, and you can always shoot us an email at nybfsports@gmail.com. Good game, everyone!